chapter 2, and we'll read from verse 10. In the 24th day of the 9th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Ask now the priests concerning the law, saying, If one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread, or pottage, or wine, or oil, or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priests answered and said, No. Then said Haggai, If one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall they be unclean? And the priests answered and said, It shall be unclean. Then answered Haggai and said, So is this people, and so is this nation before me, saith the Lord. And so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean. And now I pray you, consider this day and upward. From before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Lord, since those days were, when one came to an heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to the press vat to draw out 50 vessels out of the press, there were but 20. I smote you with blasting and with mildew and with hail in the labours of your hands, yet ye turn not to me, saith the Lord. Consider now from this day and onward, from the 24th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree hath not brought forth. From this day will I bless you.
Now, studies yesterday, we began to look at message 3 that was very much tagged on to message 2. And it was an urgent message, we said, speak now. It was an indication that there was the necessity for that, because there was the comparison that was being made between what was the glory of the former house and looking at what was happening presently in the minds of the people of God, there seemed to be something of lesser value. It is the spirit of discouragement, we said, that the enemy has a tendency of using so that he might diminish the work of God in the people of God. And we need great care to avoid comparative analysis. Yes, we said it's important to look back at history, that which we can enjoy from about 150 to 200 years ago, where there was a work of God for which we are now the beneficiaries, and we bless God for that. And we want to forever remember our history in that sense. But at the same token, we've got to be careful that we do not allow ourselves just simply to be occupied with the past in that sense and not realize that the past is intended to have a present effect upon us, a moral change. And this is what was going on for the people of God at that time. And it was necessary for the message to come, and it came specifically now to Zerubbabel, to Joshua, and to the people. be strong. It was necessary to remind our hearts that we are not to look at the surroundings of weakness, maybe, but rather to look at the strength that's available in the one whose house it is, and to lay hold on what he supplies in the matter of his power. And he reminds them that there were two specific things essential to keeping them at a level that was suitable to himself. He says, "My word and my spirit." We need to have a sense of appreciation of his word. It's valuable. He's reminded us that he has honored his word above his name. And we need to have an appreciation for his word. It is that which governs us. The path that we take requires the support of his precious word to keep us in line with that which is of himself. So he reminds us of his word, and he also reminds us of his spirit. He reminded them of these two basic elements of divine support. If we let the word slip, there will be nothing to balance us. We need to be reminded of the Spirit of God who is available to us to give us the support, the power that is needed to go on energetically. We've got the Spirit of God as that which makes the assembly the house of God, the habitation of God we are by the Spirit of God. And so it's important to have that before us. Then we spoke a bit of the shaking experiences, and we said that we're very clear that this has its prophetic view in what is yet to come, but we want to appreciate the truth of things that have gone through the shaking exercises of the people of God in order to bring them to the understanding that his glory ultimately has to fill the house. We're going to come on to this line of teaching very strongly. As I said, we hope to tie it on to the end of the last message, and I trust that the thoughts that we had yesterday would be re-emphasized very definitely. But if he has his glory in view, it is that somewhat of that feature of glory might be present among the people of God. And it is because that feature of glory was somewhat lacking that we now have the next message. Because if his glory is not supreme among us presently, then we're going to have what we get as unclean, the possibility for unclean conditions. And so we are introduced to this message, and we're going to discover who it is being spoken to. And before we just touch on that, let me read two verses that I think might be helpful. And I appreciated this morning our brother Andrew Langham's prayer as he focused in his prayer before the Lord concerning the reading this afternoon and the potential for our associations and the need for separation. I thought the Spirit of God really gave him impressions for the exercise this evening. Shall we look at Numbers 6. Just to pull a couple of expressions out of Numbers 6. Just start with the expression in the middle of verse 1. If a man or a woman have vowed the special vow of a Nazarite to consecrate themselves to Jehovah, he shall separate himself from wine, strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar of wine, nor vinegar of strong drink. Neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, nor eat grapes, fresh or dry. All the days of his separation he eat. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the vine, from the seed stones even to the skin. And the emphasis is really verse 7. Or the latter part of, well, let's read the entire verse 6. 6 and 7. All the days that he hath consecrated himself to Jehovah, he shall come near no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother, for his brother or for his sister when they die, for the consecration of his God is upon his head. All the days of his separation he is holy to Jehovah. Let's take a New Testament, 1 Corinthians 10. First Corinthians 10 and verse 21. Ye cannot drink the Lord's cup and the cup of demons. Ye cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of demons. Do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? And I'm sure that additional verses will come out to help us along. But just a comment on 1 Corinthians 10, and we thank the Lord for the exercise we had last Wednesday evening, last week. Rather in helping along, we looked at 1 Corinthians 10 and looking at associations. I believe it's the same truth that we're going to get in these verses we read in Haggai. It's a matter of separation, sanctification, our associations. These are things that we need to guard. Where separation is concerned, it has always been in the mind of God. Go back to Genesis 1. We have God separating things out. That has always been his mind. You remember when it came to the matter of Abraham and his association with Lot, there had to come a point in the experience that Abraham had to separate himself from Lot. So separation is not an awkward thing where God is concerned. It's an essential commodity. And I think we need to be in appreciation of such. Separation, sanctification, and in light of our associations, so that there might be spiritual power and energy to experience as those who are of the house of God. So here we are on the 20th day of the 9th month. It's 2 months later from what we had at the beginning of the chapter. And now we are challenged as to this matter of holiness. Remember we spoke of one of the characteristical features of the house of God is what comes up in Psalm 93, verse 5. Holiness becomes the house of God. And there is a responsibility put upon us to maintain such character.
Is it worth pointing out, David, that the first chapter of Zechariah, it's on the 8th month in the 2nd year, and the first verses of Zechariah comes in between verse 9 and 10, and perhaps at our leisure we can read them to help us on the way.
There is always a flow, we need to be reminded that there's always a flow between Haggai and Zechariah. These were the two prophets, very strong in the matter of the recovery. And so there is always going to be the interchange of things between them both.
So that would link with the scripture in the mouth of two or three witnesses.
Yes.
For the Israelite, the critical time of the year corresponds to our November and early December. December, the time when the fields have been sown. And in Israel, where there may be no rain but dew, the latter rain is essential for the new harvest. And in regard to what he has to say in verses 16 and onward, it would be a time when the Israelites would be very, very much dependent upon weather conditions suitable for producing fruit and corn. And so it was a time when they would be looking very much to the sovereignty of God in providing the rain for them.
Now, Haggai's message here is directed to the priests. It's not Zerubbabel. It's not the remnant. What is asked now, the priests. I believe there is major significance, would you not say, in the address that changes somewhat here to the priests. What would be the thoughts of the brethren?
They had a unique responsibility to Jehovah because they had been entrusted with his law, which they should have taught to the people. And verse 11 particularly is addressed to them because they should have known these things and were responsible for their maintenance. So in a peculiar way, they had a responsibility that they had not carried through in allowing conditions of uncleanness to be found amongst the people. And when God's people are unclean, then nothing is acceptable because everything is contaminated.
Actually, the priests did know, didn't yes. they? They could answer very quickly, if you like, didn't they? What Haggai asked them. And that's the same with us. We do know, don't we, really?
Yeah.
It's a question of whether we really take it to heart and put it into practice
yeah.
and observe what God says in his word.
Yeah.
There's something solemn about that because the priests were the teachers
yes.
in Israel. And they were teaching the right thing. They could give the correct answers. But they weren't practicing what they preached. They weren't living what they taught. And so searching, is it not,
yes.
for anyone who seeks to say anything for the Lord.
So you're bringing out both the worshipping capacity of the priests as well as the teaching capacity of the priests. And so if there is that which is not in line with God, then he's going to be robbed. And he's going to have to hold accountable the priests who are supposed to be here on his behalf. The priests' lips speak knowledge. The priests, they are supposed to bring in their hands, what is of Christ to God. And this is what was not present. And I'm reminded of the priests Malachi speaks of them in chapter 2 of Malachi, after the whole situation of the polluted offerings were being made in Malachi's day. He says, ultimately, the messenger of Jehovah, he says, "And now ye priests," in chapter 2, "this command is for you. You do not hear, and you do not lay it up to heart, to give glory unto my name, saith Jehovah of hosts." So the priests are held completely responsible for the bringing in what is to be in suitability to God.
I couldn't help thinking, David, in your opening remarks, when you referred to the tremendous legacy that most of us have in this room, which were the fruit of the labors of men of God of the last 200 years. We are in the privilege, like these priests were, of having been taught these things and of having them handed down to us. But the question is raised, have we handed them on to the next generation? Because whatever we receive is for the Lord's people, it's not just for ourselves. And for it to be continued, it is necessary for a succeeding generation to be taught. In fact, Timothy is an example of that, to teach others also, and so the chain goes. And it would seem here that we have priests who were instructed in the law. They knew what was suitable, and when they were challenged, they could give the right answer. But knowledge is not enough, is it? And it's the same with us, isn't it? Knowledge of the truth is essential,
yeah.
But it must lead to practical obedience and the working out of what that knowledge involves. And that seems to be what was going wrong here.
Malachi says that very definitely, doesn't he, in verse 8 of chapter 2 that was referred to. He's been speaking about the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. That's the passing on of the law of God. But then he says, but ye have departed out of the way. It was personal failure in walk, rather than a failure of knowledge.
Yes.
And I think that's what we've got in Haggai.
Yes.
We've got an example of a priest in Ezra, chapter 7, verse 10. There it says of Ezra, "For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord, and to do it, and to teach in Israel the statutes and judgments." Well, Ezra wasn't there yet during the time of Haggai.
He was both a priest and a scribe.
Yeah.
It's often been said that the truth taken in the intellect must move 12 inches down. It must move down where the heart is. And if that isn't the case, then much knowledge puffs up and will not edify. And so that's a challenge for each of us, myself, each one of us included.
Would you not also say it should move down further into your boots?
Well, beyond a shadow of a doubt, yes, it will go. If it goes to the heart, I believe that there will be a response in the feet. Because nothing ever stays at the heart level that is not effectual in movement in our lives.
David, I don't want to detract from that statement, because it is true. But what is often overlooked in referring to things that reach our affections, and that is like, but in actual fact, if it doesn't first of all reach my conscience,
that's where it begins, yes.
Because that is where the Word of God must first of all be applied to me. It's the conscience which brings me directly in relation to God. And then it can move on and be appreciated. And I'm only just added that too, because we use these expressions, the heart and whatnot. But I came across an article of Mr. Darby's just recently where he was quite emphatic about this. If the word of God doesn't reach the conscience, it doesn't produce anything.
Because it's at that point that conviction is reached.
Yes.
Yes.
I take it that this word of Haggai comes in here because the house of God was now being built and would start to be occupied and used in the worship of God, and for that to be acceptable to God, this issue of defilement must be addressed. Because worship is part of the house of God, response to God, but it must be from a clean life, a clean heart.
Well, we referred earlier to Psalm 93, if holiness is the character of the house of God, then nothing of an unholy character can find its lodging there. There will be nothing for the glory of God in regard to what is unholy. It has to be that we maintain, and it's the responsibility of the priest, to maintain those holy conditions in separation from associations that defile.
We have the two things in Leviticus chapter 10, when Aaron and his sons were given the warning in verse 9, do not drink wine nor strong drink. They need to keep their discernment when they went into the tent of meeting, lest ye die. That's how serious a matter it was. And then in verse 10 it goes on to say, and that ye may put difference between holy and unholy, which is the thing that is before us here, and between unclean and clean. So there's that priestly discernment brought before us in that verse. And then the teaching function in verse 11, and that ye may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord hath spoken unto them by the hand of Moses. So that was the Levitical law. That's emphatic.
Yes.
And so it's entirely appropriate that the priest should be singled out and asked this question here.
I think, David, as at least that scripture, and you revert to the Nazarite's vow, it might be, although it might seem very simple, that we state very clearly what wine is typical of. Because it, you know, in our day, it hasn't really got much to do with what you buy in a bottle. Wine, it's quite clearly, affects the sensibilities and brings about the fact that they became so intoxicated by it in their minds that they couldn't discern things correctly. That's literally what that verse is saying, isn't it? But we can be intoxicated by 101 things. Things we hear, things we see. They can affect us so that we become so used to that which is unclean that to us it is no longer unclean, but it is in the sight of God. So our sensibilities have become affected by being occupied and engaged in these things. This is really what is being taught here, isn't it?
Yes. And I think that this is why we need to linger here, because if we don't grapple with these truths as to the matter of what is unholy, what is is unclean. We will never be able to move on in power in this local assembly testimony or in the testimony at large. God is bringing challenge to his people here, and he's bringing challenge to our hearts as to what are my associations? Am I in the place of separation and sanctification? Because sanctification takes us a step further, doesn't it? We separate from what is unholy, but we don't just separate and stand apart like that. We must be separated onto something. So it's essential that we take that position. That which is now suitable to God is what we are separated unto. And I need to appreciate these things. Because, as you said, there is so much unholiness. And it just doesn't have to do with what is moral necessarily, you know, moral sin. But even in things that we touch, that may be legitimate in a sense, but they rob us of that position of total separation and sanctification unto God. So we need to be sensitive about these things. Indeed, isn't the internet one of those places? To be realistic, television, one of those things. Our iPads and I this and I that, and that's all that we have today. You see how Satan uses the I, an iPad, an iPod, and what's the other I? There's another one. Anyway.
It's in the middle of pride.
Definitely it is.
So what is the answer to these things? When I was younger, the great debate among brethren was, should you or should you not have a television set? And on the whole, the answer was you should not have a television set. But that's a matter of choice. But how many of us use the internet?
Yeah.
And how do we avoid seeing things we do not wish to see, which pop up? I think they're called cookies. Whatever they're called, they're not profitable very often. How do we avoid that?
I am also thinking, Brother Hugh, we may go to the internet, we may go to things of an immoral character, but I'm also thinking, as I said, the legitimate things of life. Can I not take those legitimate things and use them as that which taints my relationship with God and puts me in an unclean state?
Yeah.
Couldn't I use my vehicle to go certain places? I don't have to go to the internet. My vehicle, I can allow myself to go to certain places, do certain things that would be contemptible to the holy character of the house of God.
I don't think any of us can keep away from the things that who is speaking about. Even if you go along the street, you may see a hoarding which is defiled.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think we have to accept what David said, or the psalmist, wherewith shall a young man cleanse his ways? By taking heed according to thy word. And if we have the word of God before us, I'm sure this will have a cleansing effect on us. We might also need someone to come and wash our feet.
Yes. It's also true, though, that we should be covered vessels. And if we are going on positively with the Lord, then in a large measure we will be protected from these things. If we're enjoying communion with the Lord, we can be travelling somewhere and we can't help seeing things, we can't help hearing things. But if we're covered vessels, they won't find a place or a response in our hearts. And that's the key thing, isn't it? If they do, and our minds respond, and we give place to them in our thinking, it doesn't have to be manifested in our actions, it's sufficient to give place to them in our thinking, then our communion can be effective, and we need the cleansing of the word that Graham has been referring to. But I don't think we should limit the ability of our God to keep us, as we ourselves are exercised to keep ourselves pure.
I understand that that is literally the meaning of that verse in John chapter 17, verse 17, sanctify them through thy truth. One of the well-known writers uses the illustration of immunize them. You can move where there is a disease about, but you don't catch it because you've been immunized against it. And I understand that is the literal meaning of that verse. Immunize them by thy truth. So they don't catch what they're passing through.
I think too of the Lord Jesus himself, who could say, the prince of this world cometh and hath nothing in me. There was nothing in him that was at all attracted or at all could respond to anything the devil could put before him.
I like the thought, Brother Robert, you bringing out about covered vessels. I think that's very, very important. To be a covered vessel doesn't open me up to contaminable conditions. I am kept away from that. And if we kept ourselves as covered vessels, then the influences will have no effect whatsoever.
Well, can you tell us, David, why, when the prophet asks this question, why does he start with, can a holy thing pass its holiness onto something else, before he deals with really the side that we've been looking at, where an unholy thing can pass its condition onto the other? Why does he put the other side of it first?
Good question. Because I think that the holy thing has nothing in itself that it can convey of itself to make that which is in contact with it holy. Doesn't have the ability to pass on holiness. So a rotten apple, well, let's do it the other way around. The barrel of 12 apples, all being good, 11 of them, except one, you would think that the 11 has tremendous power to pass on its character to that single apple in the barrel that's bad. You'd hope, you'd think so, but absolutely not. So what is holy in and of itself cannot pass on holiness to anything else. The only one who can so do is God himself.
Yes. Like I suppose that the people had this idea that because they were God's chosen people and there was something special about them, which of course there was, and now they had this house that was built, that in some way that in itself was sufficient to mark them out. And of course it wasn't. They needed a change for themselves. But I suppose they had this thought that what was holy, in the sense that the house was, it was set apart for God, and they themselves were the remnants of a people set apart for God by himself, that was enough. And that, I think, is why the prophet, or the Lord, through Haggai, puts his finger on what they were thinking. And he first deals with that, to disabuse them of that notion, and then the second question touches their own, was designed to touch their own conscience as to their associations, their manner of life, and everything else.
There must be a personal work of God to make us holy.
Yeah.
It can't be conveyed from one to another.
No.
But the opposite can happen. And the next verse points that up. It really brings that into sharp relief, doesn't it? The evil, association with evil does define it.
Yes. They ceremonially, Nick, were set apart for God. And ceremonially, outwardly, they may well have looked holy. But inwardly, it was not the case. I think that is what is being said here. Because I don't want to jump down to the end of verse 14, but it's not always apparent. But they were offering sacrifices, despite the fact that they hadn't built the house. They had built the altar, and it is clear that there were sacrifices being offered on it. So not only outwardly did they look like priests, but they were actually offering sacrifices to God. But they themselves inwardly were unholy, and as a consequence so were their offerings, which is a very serious consideration.
You said yesterday, Jeff, that the moral spiritual character of an assembly is consequent upon the sum total of the parts. It reflects how we are individually, and it's no good resting on the fact that as a company we might have a certain ecclesiastical line, we might be might have this certain history, we might be outwardly on a certain course, but what about you and me? How are we? It's no good relying on what was handed to us by the generation before. And it's the same in our Christian households. I mean, thank God there is a blessing in the Christian household. The children are sanctified. They are different from the children of the world. But that shouldn't, especially as parents, nor as children, give us any sense of comfort that we're white. We can just carry on as we are because we're part of this Christian household. It's a great blessing, but there's a corresponding moral responsibility for us, and that's what I think the prophet's taking up here in this word.
We are holy. That's the starting point for the Christian. In Hebrews 2, you remember, we read verse 11, both he that sanctifies and those sanctified are all of one, for which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren. And then in verse 3, verse 1, the writer says, wherefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling. But we're occupied here with what we should be practically, which is very searching. And we get that word in 1 Peter 1,
yes.
Be ye holy, for I am holy. And interestingly, it's a quotation from the book of Leviticus, chapter 11, verse 44. And when we turn back to that chapter, it's all about what we eat. Which is, you know, again, what do we expose our minds to? What do we occupy ourselves with? Is it what can keep us so that we are exercised about keeping ourselves pure? Or are there things that we would do better to put to one side.
So what we eat supports our constitution. And that's what you're bringing out, that if I'm eating what is unholy, it will never support a holy constitution. We must be feeding on what is holy in character. I think it's nice to see how the priests, though, respond. They responded emphatically to the question. Very much so that there seemed to have been a sense in which they're able to answer verbally to the fact that whatever is holy associating itself with what is unholy will never pass on its character. The priest answered and said, no. And then comes, as Brother Nick, you were pointing out, the other side of the question that demonstrates that if there is an unclean, dead body touched, or if it touches any of these things, it impacts it and makes it unclean. So I think we need to understand clearly this matter of our associations. And that's why I read the two scriptures in Numbers and in 1 Corinthians 10, the matter of our associations. We said on the occasion last week that 1 Corinthians 10 is not just chronological with 1 Corinthians 11. It's not just simply because it's 10 and 11. But it's 10 because it's a matter of our associations if we're going to be engaged with the supper. And if I have unclean links, how can I effectively engage in the state, the occasion of the supper? And we pointed out that at the end of the verse it says, do we provoke the Lord to jealousy?
Sin is often dressed up to be attractive to our nature. But here in this verse, it's pictured for us in its awful culmination, a dead body. Sin brings death. Yeah. And I suppose if we had more of a sense of how awful sin is, what it's done to man and its dishonor to God, we wouldn't touch it as much as we do.
I think that's an important point, Simon, because we simply might ask the question, well, what is a dead body as far as we're concerned? Mm-hmm. It's very simply something that has come under the judgment of God in the death of Christ.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Could the Brethren please speak up so we can hear at the back of the hall?
Yes. A dead body represents something that has come under the judgment of God in the death of Christ. Consequently, it's unclean, morally.
So you see...
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in regard to what Geoffrey has said, I suppose we get a pretty clear description of that in the water of separation, the sacrifice of the red heifer. And of course we've got John 13, but if we're looking at the Old Testament, it's very clear in Numbers, is it 19?
Mm-hmm.
The water of separation, the red heifer that has to be sacrificed. And it refers there specifically to uncovered vessels.
Vessels, yes. Yeah. So, understanding the dead body, and it's not a matter of what may be dead for you is not dead for me. Absolutely not. It's a dead body. Across the board, it's a dead body. It doesn't have it has the sentence of death, the death of Christ upon it. And hence, I cannot associate myself with something that has the sentence of death upon it. Because then I am bringing it back to life. And I think it's a challenge as to associating ourselves with that which doesn't answer to the sufferings of Christ.
And you're suggesting, David, are you, that the truth of the Lord's table is brought in to govern our association?
Definitely.
And consequently, it's not something only for the first day of the week, it's something for every day of the week.
Absolutely.
Lifelong.
Would you say, widening it out a little bit in the mind of God, that all believers are at the Lord's table?
You asking?
I did say, would you say?
That's suggested, Andrew.
I think
you said.
Well, the analogy is to Israel.
Yes.
Behold, Israel after the flesh. Are not they that partake of the altar in fellowship with the altar? They weren't literally partaking of the altar at all times, but they are viewed as in fellowship with the altar.
And I think when you think of 1 Corinthians 10 also, you have to remember, and I think we said this too, that we're not talking about the brethren down the block, the Baptists across the way, the Pentecost here, and so forth. There was one assembly, the assembly at Corinth. All believers were there, and the apostle can then address them all as being at the Lord's table, which is the characteristical feature of every believer. It is the times in which we live where you've got the splitting up of things, the Baptists, the brethren, the this, the that. But the Apostle Paul is looking at what is corporate in its entity. Nothing else was there. Hence, it's the assembly all at the Lord's table.
Every Christian who is breaking bread is always, and I would prefer to use this expression, always associate with the Lord's table.
Yes.
We're only actually there when we are partaking of the table, which is on the Lord's Day morning. But the use of it in 1 Corinthians 10, as you've rightly been emphasizing, David, is this idea of association.
Mm-hmm.
And that never ceases, not for a moment, which is a solemn consideration for us.
Mm-hmm.
We discussed this, as you remember, the other night,
yeah.
And we tried to point out the picture that is in 1 Corinthians 10 concerning Israel in regard to those who partake of the sacrifices. Okay, we can put the supper alongside of that.
Yes.
But they were in fellowship with the altar. They may have only partaken of the sacrifice for a brief moment, but from that point onwards, they were in communion with the altar, and that went on all the time. And it is a solemn consideration, and I think it needs underlining. We don't come on a Lord's Day morning to meet at the Lord's table. You can't get away from the Lord's table. If you break bread, you're at it all the time. Because it speaks of our responsibility to maintain what goes along with the privilege of the Lord's Supper.
I think in 1 Corinthians 10 itself, we have the answer. We're told there, you cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Now, if it means breaking bread, then that statement couldn't be made, because of course it would be possible. To break bread one day, and then to be linked with the demons in the week. And the apostle is saying, you cannot. So it's, as Jeff has said, it's more than that. The partaking at the supper, of course, must be the expression of the Lord's table. It's the greatest expression of the Lord's table. But it's not only that, and I think that's the challenge, really, the application here in our verses, that what do outwardly, representatively, on the first day of the week, it should be representative of our portion every day, moment by moment. And this is the matter. These people had now a house, they had a position, but the question was, were they true to that day by day? And they weren't, because the Lord Jehovah had to put his finger on it through the prophet to show them that they were inconsistent. Practically, that what they were actually and practically was inconsistent with what they took up positionally, especially now the house was built and they needed to bring those two things in line with one another.
I remember many, many years ago this question came in connection with the Lord's Table.
A little louder.
Sorry, yeah, I beg your pardon. And Frank Wallace pointing out that the view of the early brethren was very clearly, from their writings, that the Lord's Table and the Lord's Supper are largely synonymous. And I think that's right.
That's a view that I have heard taught.
You better explain that to us, because some of us don't know what the word synonymous means.
There's a brother here who doesn't have more brains than I have.
Than me.
the Lord's Supper and the Lord's Table can be identified with one another. They're one and the same thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of contradicting what Nick has just said. And I'm just giving another view. And that is that we are only actually at the Lord's Table when we come together to remember the Lord. And that's when we partake of the Lord's Table. I take it when it says ye cannot partake of the Lord's Table and the table of demons, that what Paul is saying is that is actually morally impossible. But the truth of chapter 10, we are agreed in this regard, that it has to do with the constancy of our association with the Lord's Table. But one of the things you were talking about the internet, there are some fantastic, it's not the problem, some really good Bible websites that one can access. Including Les Hodgett's site, STEM Publishing, and you can search the writings of the early brethren. And that's one of the things that I began to do actually before I came to the conference, and that I would like to finish doing when I go back. So I look forward to a conference on the subject of the Lord's Table where the brethren can put me right on this.
I think the Lord's Table is positional in chapter 10 because it rests on the communion of the blood of Christ, and we being many are one bread and one body, but we are all partakers of that one bread. So we're brought into a position of the Lord's Table, at the Lord's Table, but what we do there is dealt with in chapter 11.
I trust we will sort these things out, but just to say this, again, in Corinth, every individual that was at the breaking of bread was at the Lord's Table. There was no, as I said, separate company over here, one here and one there. Everybody in Corinth, they were at the Lord's Table, and hence there is what is synonymous there with the supper, because they were partaking of the supper. We're in a different day where fragmentation has occurred and raises the question whether everybody is at the Lord's Table or not. I believe sufficient to say the Lord's table is a sphere of fellowship to which every believer has been brought. And we'll ferret this out a little further. But for now, brethren, the matter of unclean conditions. Unclean conditions, again, going back to our associations, because what the Haggai is now saying to the priests as they answer the fact that, yes, if I associate myself with unclean things, I will become contaminated by them. And he says to them now, that's what you have been. That's what the people of God have been when you seemingly have been running to and fro from God's house. Instead of focusing on God's house, you are engaged in building your own houses. That made you unclean. And that's a condition that existed because you were sold on your own personal interests.
And this is said to the remnant, to those who had come back from Babylon, and to those who positionally were separated. They were in the right place. Morally speaking, their behavior, their associations, and what they allowed was all wrong. Mm-hmm. And that today is very challenging to us.
So we can be in the right position, but morally speaking, not maintaining what is associated with that right position.
Yes, we shouldn't compartmentalize our lives. And I must say, I've seen some very extravagant letters of commendation as to claims that are made. Mm-hmm. We're separated from all known evil. And we're the company that are walking in separation from iniquity, as if to emphasize, it's almost as if assemblies are vying with each other to state how separated they are in regard to ecclesiastical questions as to the positional aspect. I must say, I tremble when I read those letters or have them read, because I say to myself, are those who are making such claims for themselves in their individual walk and in their personal lives, are they answering to it in practice?
I think...
And I bring it home to myself.
Yes, I would follow that through. Because if there were more young people here, I think some of them would be a little bit clouded in their minds through some of the things that have just been said. And dear who? I think we have to be careful about talking about the thing being positional. There is no power in a position unless it is backed up by what is inward and personal. Sanctification is not just positional. These priests were sanctified positionally, but they were unclean.
Yes, I accept that, absolutely.
Yes, but it's just... I mean, see, when we were young, it was much simpler than it is today, and I just use an illustration. If you wanted to see a film, you had to go to the pictures. And in going there, you became associated with other people. You can see a film today without going to the pictures. So it's not a matter of positional or direct association. It's more intense than that. It's to do with inward, what's in my mind, what I'm being occupied with.
Yes,
so it's not just an outward association, it's inward as well.
Yes, I wasn't implying any...
I didn't think you did. I was just trying to say this in case we gave a wrong impression.
But comments were made, like every believer is at the Lord's table. That must be positional. That's all I meant by
on the principle that every privilege carries a responsibility. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To one simple mind, one can see that, in fact, it was said in this room many, many years ago, that the Lord's table is the responsibility of bread breakers. If you're breaking bread, you have a responsibility, and that is the sphere of the Lord's table. But you partake of the privilege, you have then a responsibility to walk. Again, the brethren years ago used to talk about the instruction for the priests to keep the charge 7 days. They may only served at the altar for one day, but they had to keep the charge of the Lord 7 days, which is the whole period.
David, do you want to move us on a bit?
Yes, we'll. We're not going to more than likely pick up the last piece of this message, because we'll tag it on tomorrow, God willing, because I felt that the whole matter of cleanliness is so paramount that the brethren will engage today with looking at that. Because if we don't get through this matter of clean associations or unclean associations, I think our fellowship will continue in a dysfunctional way. And we need to address that. And I think the Spirit of God has really given help. And that's why I think at the end of this whole matter, the apostle Haggai.
He was sent indeed.
But David, what we're dealing with here, and I think it's been said, is the principle that association with evil defiles.
Definitely.
In the New Testament language, a little leavens the whole lump. Morally, in Corinthians, and doctrinally, I think in Galatians.
Yes.
And that is a principle that is contested today.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, I was putting a great deal of literature into other Christian bookshops. And the only thing I was ever requested to take back was something on this subject. I can't quite remember if it was association with evil, does it defile, by A.E. Booth, which is certainly worth reading and studying, or whether it was G.C. Willis, The Law of the Leper, and he gave it a gospel application. Someone may have thought he was dealing with leprosy and uncleanness in the house and other issues. But one of those titles, Customer Complaint, and the shopkeeper asked me to take the stock of that particular title back. Well, that may illustrate that it's contrary to much that is found around us, where people would advise you to go into an association or to stay in a church association to try and help those that were there and to raise the standard. And we can, it is capable of very wide applications. Not that you'll be dragged down to their level, not that the good will be corrupted by the bad, but that the good will have an effect in purifying the rest. And Haggai here is telling us that it's the very opposite. And it's a principle that came to light in the whole matter of Plymouth and Bethesda, which really was a turning point in the history of the brethren. That was taught then and afterwards in writing that association with evil does not defile, and that allowed evil in. Mm-hmm. And it was also taught that assemblies were autonomous or independent, and on that basis, there was no power or no principle then to put the evil out. The one allowed the evil in, and the other principle gave no power to put the principle out. So this is a very important passage in keeping with New Testament teaching also. I'm just putting that into context. I haven't
changed
it too much.
No, I think you are highlighting essentially what one had in mind for this afternoon's exercise, that we might focus on this issue of our associations. And just before I come to the last phrase that I want us to just simply emphasize, going back to the Nazarite vow, we see the conditions that were associated. Now, we know the Nazarite vow was a voluntary vow, and it was open to anyone. And there was the exercise to be taken up by the male or the female. We are in a state today in the Christian company where the Nazarite vow should be the thing that we are taking up.
Yeah.
We have to take up the Nazarite vow. Mm. And in taking it up, we are challenged that you cannot come near a dead body. And it says it doesn't matter who that dead body is. Could be my father, my mother, my brother, my sister. I have the consecration of God upon my head, and therefore I cannot. And it's a challenge as to how we define our associations so that we stand in the clear line of the teaching of God's word concerning the fact that I cannot. The Haggai points out in the end, he says, I pray you, consider. I wonder if that might not be the climax to which the Spirit of God might bring us for today. He says, I pray you, consider. And the consideration now is upward is really backward. What was before, we'll come to another upward, which is forward. But he's saying, we need to look back. Spot of the history and consider from which we have come so that there can be an upward movement. Trust that that would be the prayer of our hearts to consider.